Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I recently conducted a series of interviews with some Taliban activists, and my research focus is mainly on the narratives, on understanding their enemy images, understanding their grievances, understanding their battle. A Talib originally just means a student. It's just to give you a really, really short background. The name came because of a small group of students affiliated to the madrasa in Peshawar called Darul Ulum Haqqaniya, where some Afghani refugees organized with some Pakistani students and went back to Afghanistan after the Soviet Union was withdrawn to establish peace and order in Afghanistan. That was actually their vision, to stop the warlords from fighting and creating destruction and fighting each other, and they wanted to create a more unified Afghanistan. Otherwise, the Taliban movement in Pakistan, you know, historically has not, you know, it has not existed. The name was given afterwards, mostly by Westerners who tried to categorize these movements. I wanted to now, in the last session, we discussed the U.S. Policies against towards Afghanistan and Pakistan, and on March, in the end of March, I think it was the 27th of March, President Obama announced his new policy, basically arguing that it was necessary to broaden our view on the problem, and that saying that the issues of Afghanistan and Pakistan was closely intertwined. And also he clarified why we are there. It's not to, you know, it is not for nation building or to save the women or to democratize, but it is basically to get those who did 9/11. It's to get Al-Qaeda, and it is to get those who are supporting Al-Qaeda activists. And that is... I completely agree with Richard Falk's basic view on the necessity of demilitarization, but in one way, it was this declaration was a very maybe a more honest declaration, you know, saying why we are there, our motives of it, and maybe also a policy which is more, you know, based on a more consistent view on why we are in Afghanistan and why we are now going into Pakistan and why we are not in other countries also demanding, you know, having huge problems with human rights and gender relations and so on. Why we are not in, for example, different African countries and so on. And lately we have also been discussing this possibility, it was mentioned, for pursuing a policy of differentiation to negotiate or to deal with some of these Taliban groups in Pakistan. But not many people know about the different Taliban fractions in Pakistan and how different they actually are, and, you know, their historical development in Pakistan. And I will just try to give you a brief overview on the different groupings right now and their differences and who can be, you know, talked to and who cannot be talked to. This map just places where it all started initially. The yellowish or the orange color is the tribal areas, and the blue, the areas colored with blue, is the Northwest Frontier Province, which is normally called the settled areas. The tribal areas has historically been autonomous areas, not being ruled under the Pakistani rule of law, but having their own system of governance. Process of Talibanization has actually sweeped through whole of the, you know, the entire tribal areas, and also in most of the northwest frontier province now. Especially the major clashes, you know, between the Pakistani security forces has been in the northwest frontier province, because in those areas it has been, you know, illegal to create these alternative administrations that Taliban has created in many places. Is it possible to distinguish between the good and the bad and the ugly Taliban? In Pakistan right now, estimated, we have 30 to 40 different Taliban fractions. Pakistan, which is the largest Taliban organization, was established in 2007. With 27 different fractions, you know, participating or being part of this umbrella organization. It is led by Baitullah Masood, who is placed in South Waziristan. You can see it on the map there. He has been, you know, he is the most portrayed of the Taliban leaders in Pakistan. He's also the most wanted, but still he can make, you know, it's possible for him to do press conferences, even though they're for specific journalists. So there are many questions about, you know, Baitullah Masood and the interest of the Pakistani ISI and the interest of the American military intelligence to keeping these Taliban activists alive somehow and active. Then we have the second fraction, which is organized around Mullah Nazir, who belongs to the Ahmadzai Wazir faction. The Masood tribe and the Ahmadzai Wazir tribe have always been competing tribes in the region. They're both from South Waziristan, but the disagreement appeared when Mullah Nazir, he opposed the Baitullah Masood decision to protect foreign fighters. And the foreign fighters in the region, that is mostly the Uzbek fighters from Uzbekistan, from the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, and the Al-Qaeda-affiliated activists, which is estimated to be around 300 to 500 persons. So it's not a huge, you know, it's not a huge crowd we are talking about. It's 300 to 500 persons. So Mullah Nazir, he opposed that, and he got support from Hafiz Gul Bahadur, which is from North Waziristan and belongs to a third tribe, which is the Torikil tribe. And he got into a fight with Baitullah Masood because of the differences in opinion about whether they should fight or cooperate with the Pakistani security forces. Baitullah Masood, he saw the Pakistani security forces to be legitimate targets, whereas Hafiz Gul Bahadur has always resisted, or he wanted to work together with the Pakistani security forces, especially against the foreign fighters. So the Mullah Nazir and the Hafiz Gul Bahadur made an alliance of alternative, of different Taliban groups. And for a long time they had this, different fights going on against each other. But very recently, after actually President Obama, he announced the deployment of 21,000 more American troops to Afghanistan, it is said, or it is reported, that Mullah Umar, the leader of the Afghani Taliban, went to, tried to make them join forces again. And after that, they announced that it's just recently, a couple of months ago, they announced that they have put their differences aside and now they want to fight, you know, in unity against the foreign occupation forces in Afghanistan. So that has been an example for many people saying that this militaristic approach is not helping. It is only worsening the problem because it is, first of all, it is recruiting more people to these Taliban factions. And secondly, it is uniting all these different factions which call themselves Taliban and who shares the interpretation of Sharia and Islamic law, but who who are very different in their approach to negotiation and how and violence, basically. And then we have the Sawati Taliban, which we have heard so much about in the news lately, causing all these refugees. Taliban in Sawat was, again, not a phenomenon until recently in 2007, where they joined the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. Before that, what is called the Sawati Taliban today was a movement called the Tehrik-e-Nifaz-e-Shariat-e-Muhammadi, a movement basically working to implement Sharia in Sawat, in the valley of Sawat. It was a local, Islamic movement wanting, rallying to, make the Pakistani constitution's promise implement, promise of Sharia law in Pakistan implemented. So its leader, Sufi Muhammad, he was jailed after 2001, where he and his son-in-law, Mullah Fazlullah, went to Afghanistan to fight against the foreign occupation forces. These two, the Sufi Muhammad and his son-in-law, they develop a difference because while Sufi Muhammad was in jail until recently, Mullah Fazlullah, he started to militarize this movement, Tanzeem-e-Nifaz-e-Shariat-e-Muhammadi. And the peace deals actually that the Pakistani government did recently in February was with Sufi Muhammad, who do not support the approach of his son-in-law and who do not support the militarization of his movement. So the Pakistani government did it allegedly to make, the father-in-law convince his son-in-law to lay down arms and to, be more concerned about the people of the valley. Then we have different new constellations coming up. We have something called the Punjabi Taliban. Normally, the Taliban in Pakistan has been a Pashtun phenomenon and belonging to the Deobandi trend. Recently, we have seen some alliances between the more classic Taliban, if we can, say that there's something called the classical Taliban, the Baitullah Masood-led fractions, and movements such as Lashkar-e-Taiba and movements such as Sipah-e-Sahaba in Pakistan, which is an anti-Shiit sectarian organization, and an organization called Lashkar-e-Jangvi, which is also a sectarian anti-Shiit organization. And especially Baitullah Masood is cooperating closely with these fractions. And normally we have seen Lashkar-e-Taiba, for example, on the other side of the Pakistani border, fighting in Kashmir and not on the Afghani side of the border. So these new alliances are quite interesting, especially because there are many theories and speculations also about the role, as I mentioned, of the intelligence services in the Mohmand agency. If you can see it up there in the tribal areas, there was a case with the Shah group. I don't know if you have heard about it in the media, but there was the more classical Taliban was fighting this Mohmand group Shah group in the Mohmand agency. And the Shah group is a Salafi movement, which is closer to the Al-Qaeda ideology. Whereas the Deobandi, as you know, follows a school of jurisprudence, follows the Hanafi school of law. They have interpretational, you know, differences. But in this agency, there was a case with this Shah group, which later it was, you know, discovered that the leader of this Shah group was actually a leading member also of Lashkar-e-Taiba. And Lashkar-e-Taiba has also traditionally been known to have close ties with the Pakistani military intelligence service, the ISI. So there has also been some news about the Pakistani intelligence or the military intelligence service supporting the Hafiz Gul Bahadur and the Mullah Nazir fractions against the Baitullah Masood group to fight them and to arm them. And there was something about them being actually on the pay list of the ISI, some of the leading members of the Hafiz Gul Bahadur and the Mullah Nazir group. And then the latest outshoot has been the Tehreek-e-Taliban in Balochistan and the Tehreek-e-Taliban in Peshawar, but we don't know much about them yet. But they should have, as it is presented in the Pakistani news, they are alternative organizations to the Tehreek-e-Taliban in Pakistan, which is the Baitullah Masood-led group. So when I interviewed these, different activists from these different groups, the three or the main, unifying arguments among them was that they feel, or their perception of the whole situation is that they're under attack. That U.S. is here to create destruction and chaos in our part of the world, and U.S. intends to prevent every Islamic system from existing in the world. And further, what they do is to, which is, you know, in contradiction to the traditional Islamic jurisprudence, is to individualize the duty of jihad. And they explain this, this emergency behavior because, with reference to that they are in a defensive situation. So clearly they are they're understanding their war as defensive, and they don't see that, for them the history didn't start 9/11 but way before, with U.S. interventionist policies and so on. And so they're convinced that this is a campaign led, an anti-Islamic campaign led by the United States. And I think it is really important to take that seriously when we think of, resolution and which policies to pursue. It is important to understand who, the people we are fighting as Americans. Now, I'm not an American, but I'm just using that category. What they are feeling threatened by it, what their grievances are, in order to understand a better way to de-escalate the conflict dynamics. Because right now, as it is clearly, if you look at earlier the Bush rhetoric and now also the Obama, it's clearly the U.S. perception also that we were under attack, our values of freedom were attacked that day in 9/11. But the same is actually true if you look, if you listen to the narratives on the other side. They have, precisely the same image that their, freedom was under attack or has been attacked, and their sovereignty is under attack, and they're systematically being attacked by foreign occupation forces. I will not go into, I know that I don't have much time, so I will not go into the more, detailed description of the individual activists. But if you look at, normally at just war theory, how we explain our wars in the West, normally we have this, five or six ways to legitimize why we are doing what we are doing. And do we have if it's a last resort, if we have the right motive, if, all these things I have written down here. And again, if you look, if you listen to the narratives and the grievances of these, we have, those we are fighting in Pakistan and Afghanistan, they would have exactly something to fill in these things too. They also feel that they have the right motivation or the motive. They also see their fight as the last resort, and so on and so on. And they also have debates about discrimination. You know, who is the guilty, who is the innocent, who is a legitimate target, who is not a legitimate target. I think it is worrying. If you look at this, I don't know if you can see it, the survey on top, it's a recent survey from 2008 showing that actually if you ask the Pakistani population, 44% of the Pakistanis would say that it is the United States who poses the biggest threat to their personal safety. Yeah, 44%, yeah. While, you know, the traditional enemy, India, was in comparison only 14%, and only 8% identified the Pakistani Taliban, 6% identified the Al-Qaeda, and 4% identified the Afghani Taliban. So that is something to be to be very worried about. And I will just end up with a story from last, I think it was last summer, when I was following the Pakistani news broadcast. There was a story of this terrorism-charged Afia Siddiqui, who disappeared, I think, in 2003 in Karachi, a town in Pakistan. Suddenly in 2008, last summer, her picture appeared in one of the largest Pakistani newspapers, where she evidently was, you know, heavily she was abused, and she was, her face was, you know, really maltreated. And the story was that she had been abused under these many years of U.S. custody, and also raped, and her children disappeared, and so on. And in Pakistan, it was really a big story. And most of the analysts from the Pakistani universities and, you know, people who don't support the Taliban version of Islam or Sharia and Islamic law, but, you know, they still somehow created a sense of solidarity with the Taliban movement, saying that look how they treated our, one of our imprisoners, while we, you know, referring to the case where the British journalist Yvonne Ridley was captured by the Taliban in 2001. When she was released, she converted, you know, to Islam after her release, being so impressed by the Taliban treatment of her. So suddenly that was just the, you know, repeated story by many of the analysts and news reporters in Pakistan. There was a sense of solidarity with the Taliban movement, not because they represent this very, we can say, twisted interpretation of Sharia and Islamic law, but because they were the voices of resistance against foreign occupation forces. And that is really, really important to, I think, keep in mind, that why is Taliban in Pakistan gaining success? We should not underestimate the power of resistance narratives or the idea of resistance, because that is really what has, you know, really mushroomed all these Taliban movements in Pakistan since 2001, because before that it was not really a phenomenon in Pakistan at all.
I think it's a question why we academics don't see what's happening on the ground. So this panel of people on the ground, I think, is really important. And what you just showed us, that the Taliban is kind of an umbrella category or an epithet given by its other and not really appropriate for people on the ground, is so important. There are so many Talibans. And in Afghanistan, the same is true. When we say we're fighting the Taliban, what the heck does it mean, right? Well, I started, I am an anthropologist. We study on the ground, face to face. And I started studying the Sikh insurgents in Punjab following Edward Said's advice, who had said about post-colonial scholars, you know, it's not enough to invite our post-colonial others into our salons with their weapons deposited politely at the door and discuss over a cup of tea where we should proceed. We have to meet them in the field with their weapons on. And I think that's true. And I guess Mona thinks it's true, too, because that's the only conversation that we can have that some kind of truth will really emerge about their situation and what is really going on in their world. So I started out with studying the Sikhs, and later on I moved on to studying Kashmiri Mujahideen. And rather than tell you a lot of anecdotes about me amongst the fighters, let me say that what I did was I proceeded in a kind of a crescent-like way, if you can picture that map, across northern Pakistan to the edge of Afghanistan, group to group to group. And that, in fact, it's definitely true that these groups are linked not just by an alliance, a natural alliance, one to the other, but by the Pakistani ISI as a kind of spider web, in a spider web fashion. The fighters are, they started out a few years back, 10 years back, they were indigenous.
I'm going to ask
Mona
to bring up the map.
The map, okay. They were mostly in the beginning, whether we talked about Sikhs or Kashmiris, indigenous, young, much like my Notre Dame students. A lot of people don't like that analogy, but I felt like I was with my students when I was among them. Young, very secular, a middle-class origin, very educated. But over time, I've seen this change across that crescent that I'm talking about, where that group of fighters have become increasingly religious, increasingly more youthful, increasingly more peasant, more of peasant origins, less educated. And when I say religious, what I mean is, of course, Islamization. There's been a gradual Islamization. There's been, of course, a greater and greater influence from Pakistan in the direct form of Pakistani fighters actually joining into these different groups. And then international fighters. And I can describe, for example, one field trip along the line of control in Kashmir. The first time when I started doing field work there at some of the bases of Mujahideen along the line of control, they were almost all Indian Kashmiri fighters, a few Pakistanis. A few years later, when I went back along that same line of control, there were Algerians, Libyans, Saudis, a few Chechens, all across. You know, it had become a pan-Islamic cause very quickly. Okay. One of the things I recognized, by the way, visiting the line of control, maybe some of you have done that as well, the refugee flow, the refugee camps that you can see in along the Pakistani side of that line of control, they're vast refugee tents and tents and tents all along, you know, people crawling out of the mountains with frostbitten arms and legs and wounds and, okay. So if I had wondered whether somebody was trying to pull something over on me or create stories and tell me lies to invent something because they hated a certain country, I definitely realized otherwise when I saw thousands and thousands of refugees, which could not have been arranged for my benefit. And I realized when I saw who was helping those refugees, who was there when they stumbled from India, the democracy, to Pakistan, at that time the Zia dictatorship, an interesting phenomena that evokes Agamben and some of his theories, who was there handing them blankets, you know, tending to their wounds. Islamic, radical Islamic organizations of various stripes were there. Not Western aid organizations, not internet. That's who was there helping those people. So that's one beginning of an answer as to why people turned, to why people join, why people turn. They were the ones there helping them when they needed their help. And the same is true in Palestine and other places as well. So that's one thing. So a lot of them joined those groups. Right then and there, they thanked him. Thanks for helping me. Thanks for tending to my wounds. Okay, I'll fight for you. And they did. A lot of them don't have jobs. They're there. They're refugees without a job. Those groups pay money. They pay pretty good money. Some of them just plain old need a job and they join. And others are young kids, just like my Notre Dame students, who want to join the ROTC and go fight in Iraq. They're patriotic. It's romantic. Their girlfriend thinks they look good in a military uniform, their version of one, and they join. There's a raffishness about it, right? A second area to be clear on. They may be joining all that, but the leaders are intellectuals, and they're thinking on a different level, okay? And they're tied into the ISI. The ISI is an actor on the ground, and as Mona brought in there, I'm so glad you said it, the U.S. is an actor on the ground. The U.S. and the ISI are actors on the ground. So I think it's disingenuous to phrase this as if somehow we are looking in on this from outside. We have been actors on the ground from the beginning, from the anti-Soviet Afghan war, and have been throughout and still are now. We are part of the actors on the ground. It's up to us whether we choose not to be now, but we are part of it and have been part of it and part of these groups. As everybody knows, we started them. We started re-evoking the concept of individual jihad, re-evoking this kind of transnational Islamism in order to fight, you know, the Russians and the Soviets, and we won the Cold War because of it. What people don't often talk about is, you know, the very concept of al-Qaeda. The base is an anti-colonial concept that had always had, from the beginning, two stages. It always had, as a first stage, to fight the superpower of the Soviet Union, and the second stage, which we don't hear as much about, to fight the superpower of the United States. It was an explicitly anti-colonial self-determination for the Islamic world movement. And, of course, we left after the first stage. But they didn't forget that they had promised a second stage in there, okay? And I will comment at my conclusion why I think we ought to remember that second stage. From the time of our original support and then our betrayal of that support by leaving them hanging, masterless Ronin after the Afghan war, till now, the fact is, I'll say outright what I think, what I in fact know, but it's controversial. 9/11 happened, and there's some a lot of controversy in that part of the world about it. But I think the hunt for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda has been a kind of mythic diversion in United States discourse, in Western discourse. Because the matter of fact is, the serious problem for the United States is Pakistan's nukes, not Osama bin Laden. I mean, any reasoning person could know that a $50 million bounty and the superpower of the world with all its resources could not fail to find a person after all these years. And the real danger is, of course, not Iran, who is slowly, maybe, do they have, could they build, might there be an Islamic bomb, but Pakistan, an Islamic country which already has a full nuclear arsenal. Now, it has a government which is restrained. Musharraf was restrained. The current government is restrained. But what we have always feared is, will there be an Islamist, a radical Islamist takeover in Pakistan, which would then use that nuclear arsenal in an unrestrained way? And from the beginning, since, you know, 9/11 and the terrorist acts preceding 9/11, the U.S. military, despite political rhetoric, has had its eyes on that problem. And that's why when President Musharraf constantly would back down and make treaties with the Taliban, with different groups and with the tribals, and we'd kind of back off and say, well, we can't, it's the sovereignty, and Americans would say, tell them, crack down, they got to fight harder, they got to find Osama. Well, in fact, I think the United States was fully complicit. We didn't want to crack down. We were making deals the whole way along because the most important thing was not finding Osama bin Laden. The most important thing has been preserving the stability of Pakistan, because we wanted to preserve the stability of those nukes. That was the most important thing. We knew if there was too heavy a hand on a crackdown by us or by Musharraf, there'd be an Islamic backlash, and then you might get Islamists taking over those nukes. And that is now what is happening, right now. So just as Richard Falk said, that's why I was on board with what he said. Now that Obama's eyes have turned from Iraq, appropriately thinking of withdrawing from Iraq, but now turning to Afghanistan, you know, since we see the drone attacks, since we see the current government now cracking down, as it has, with many more civilians killed than potential terrorists killed. People are joining the Taliban, as you pointed out, for resistive reasons. Not for these other reasons, for resistive reasons. For direct anti-occupation reasons. Anti-Americanism is like it has never been before. I have always traveled very safely in that region. I have a Muslim last name. I have always been trusted by these groups. I spent my entire career building that trust. But anti-Americanism is now so high, I doubt that I can do this anymore. That means something is not working about the way we're doing things, right? This is now a direct anti-occupation, not anti-colonial in the broad sense, global, but a directly personal anti-occupation movement. I want to say something that, historical as well. Lord Curzon, the former Viceroy of India, he ended 100 years of the British fighting with the Afghans by saying, I'm going to quote, "No patchwork scheme will do. Not until the military steamroller has passed over this country from end to end will there be peace. But I do not want to be the one to start that process." And for those wise words, he was made Foreign Secretary of the British Empire. Now, from there, I'll also, as being the generation I am, have to turn to the Vietnam era, where, you know, Michael Herr, the journalist of that era, said about the unstoppability of the U.S. war machine, even though it seemed also to be evoking more resistance and not less among the Vietnamese, that same durability of the indigenous resistance. Michael Herr said, "Our war machine was devastating and versatile and adaptable. But one thing was true of the U.S. war machine. It could do everything but stop." And this perhaps speaks to the military-industrial complex argument. And I'm afraid it may be true here. What it has to do is stop. And, you know, Kennedy, like Obama, was a young, very popular president who called on the enormity of the stakes. And that's what's true right now, the enormity of the stakes, called on the nobility and the restraint of the U.S., and yet, at the same time, was in fact militarily escalating what was going on. Was culturally escalating a colonization of the world against which we see the backlash right now. If you look at downtown markets in Pakistan or in Afghanistan, girls are carrying around Barbie dolls, and some of us Americans apparently find that this a great sign of liberation, that instead of the burqa, there used to be a Barbie doll colloquially called Tehran Barbie. Maybe some of you saw it. It was a doll with a burqa. Well, now instead of that, they've got the real Barbie, Malibu Barbie, you know. Now, are we supposed to feel happy about that? I don't, as an anthropologist. Dr. Saeed Iskander, she's the director of Iraq's National Archive and Library. She said recently that she said this destruction of the art and the archives and the books of Iraq, you know, has scarred the heart of Iraqis far more than the bombs have and will have much more long-term repercussions in the attitude of Iraqis toward the West. Maybe it's because I'm an anthropologist, but I believe that is true, that the cultural impact and the cultural colonization that we may have may be the more serious problem. Academia is complicit. You know, academia itself is so neo-colonial, and many of us in our fields, we know, still consider people from other parts of the world more as informants than colleagues, especially those who are not from the middle class and not educated at Oxford, you know, but true others from other knowledge traditions, such as religion, such as shamanic traditions. So one of the things I want to call for is a willingness to truly dialogue with other alternate sources of knowledge. Those Talibanis who went to madrasas, they have a kind of knowledge that actually needs to be entered into a discourse with and not just called crazy fanaticism. They have some things to teach us. And so as to what I'd like to offer, we say demilitarize, but not disengage. Well, what I have to say about that is, first thing is, I think it's time for a really fully regional approach to this problem. And the only way Pakistan can deal with its internal problems is if we help Pakistan deal with the Kashmir issue. It's had to focus its full national energy on India and Kashmir because that has been an unresolved border since the beginning of Pakistan. Now, the U.S. can't be the one to lead this. It has to be a plurality of nations, including Russia, China, India, Iran, the Central Asian nations. And for the first time, I think there may be a chance for it. Why? Because it's against India's interest, too, that those nukes should go off under the hands of militant Islamists in Pakistan. For the first time, there's a lot of people that have a huge stake in resolving Kashmir. So I would say that now is the time, and so get Saudi Arabia to put pressure on Pakistan. They're the ones that can put the pressure. The U.S. isn't. We're not the ones anymore. But now is maybe a chance to resolve this Kashmir thing, because unless Pakistan takes its eyes off Kashmir, it won't handle anything else. Secondly, this is the time for Obama to deal with the Palestinian problem and others, and other people, not just Obama. But the Palestinian problem is the crux of a lot of Islamic rage, a lot of the source of historic humiliation of Muslims. If Obama could have a, or and if not Obama, if there could be a Palestinian state within the next foreseeable future, it would resolve so much of the problem of Islamic violence, I believe. Thirdly, I think that educating against Islamophobia, and I mean that, you know, loudly, fearlessly, everywhere, every day, all the time. I think, you know, it means a lot that under the Obama administration, we're now becoming a nation that follows international law, and we're not going to be a rogue state. We might not be a light unto the world, but at least we're not a rogue nation. But I think, you know, even we in academia, of course we abhor hate speech, but That's how genocides happen. Other good people abhor it, but they just avoid talking about it. And meanwhile, outside there, other people slide further and further and further into hatred. And I think we need to be more active about educating about Islam and forcefully talking against Islamophobia. And lastly, I think we need to think, as Mona says, into the future, and recognize the second part of the Al-Qaeda plan. This is, now I'm talking about intellectual Muslims who are part of what they call the Islamic Renaissance, not Islamic terrorism, it's the Islamic Renaissance. And we sort of lower that by saying, oh, they want a caliphate, they want to return to the caliphate, just like we lower their martyrdom by saying they want virgins in heaven, and this is ridiculous. The intellectuals of the movement are saying, having fought off the Soviets, the next thing is to fight off America and global capitalism. And they recognize that they have natural allies in the anti-globalization movement, the World Social Forum, Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales. They are reaching out to some of these people. Now, I think there's a problem because the progressive left in the West has so bought into the idea that radical Islam is a regressive right-wing fanatic, so we can't possibly see that that's a future alliance. But they're building that alliance, so we got to think way outside the box about what this movement is and what we can do. Thank you.
I'm particularly happy that the discussion is moving in the direction of really finding out from the historical vantage point and to the contemporary understanding how to demilitarize and how to disengage and re-engage in a different way. I think Cynthia Mahmood's point leads us in the direction of a democratic re-engagement of everybody, so that some of our shared values we can pursue. I'm going to make a few points about why groups like mine, Pakistan India People's Forum for Peace and Democracy, the PUCL, PUDR, and all the civil liberty groups in India, and the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, and several groups in Pakistan, and several groups elsewhere in the world, especially some groups in Europe and U.S., have actually opposed very strongly the Obama surge in Afghanistan-Pakistan region. And there are several reasons we have pointed out, and I will stress on a few of them. The context is, for whatever reason, and some of the reasons came up in the first panel, industrial military complex, Wall Street, Israel, and several others, and the new elite confluence of the subcontinental, particularly the Indian elite and the American elite and the strategic partnership which the elites have forged between India and the U.S. There are several explanations. But one thing is very clear. The failure in Afghanistan is now sought to be compensated by a new strategy which includes this surge. And that has to be underlined. The 21,000 more troops in Afghanistan and the trilateral initiative between U.S., Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And they were just waiting for the Indian elections. Now India, which already is part of the new strategy since the nuclear deal, will be drawn into supporting this. And the so-called strategic leadership of India, which shares much of the Nyokan approach, is already supporting the army operations in Swat. So the Indian media, if you just see the television, read the main newspapers, it's also supporting that. Therefore, this new strategy is the U.S.-led response to tackle the failures in Afghanistan, where today more than 60% of the territory is not under the control of the Karzai regime. Now, I'm going to suggest that reasons for the opposition opposition to Obama's policy are also reasons for opposing a certain understanding of the phenomenon of terrorism and violence in the contemporary world and in Asia, which has informed U.S. policy. And that understanding has to be challenged. And that mainstream academic input which has gone into that, and such great stalwarts here, their views haven't informed the American policy. It is some other views. As against that kind of understanding, I'm going to suggest that three propositions have to be promoted as working propositions, and the scholarly work has to be marshaled in support of those propositions. One, I think we should try to strengthen the local forces of harmony and reason. What has happened is that U.S. policy and the Petraeus kind of counterinsurgency manual from Vietnam to now, it has, particularly in the post 9/11 era, it doesn't look at the complexity and the plurality. And already Mona has pointed out, the plurality even in the name of Taliban. But if you look at the subcontinent as a whole, just as in India, the Hindu fundamentalist attempt to project India as a Hindu society and Hindu nation has failed to convince majority of Indians. And the recent elections are yet another testimony to that. Similarly, in Pakistan, also there is a plurality, and that is being discussed. And I'm sorry to say that American media is completely ignoring that. The the perception of Jinnah, which Stanley Ulpert and Ainsley Emery both referred to, whether it was to be an Islamic state or a state where Muslims are in majority, and a Muslim majority state which gives certain protection to Muslims in the subcontinent and in Pakistan, which he envisaged as a plurality of nationality, ethnic identities, and religions. That's why Pakistan is a federation. And, you know, the present armed operation is very often seen as a Punjabi army's occupation, Punjabi army's onslaught on the Pashtuns or Baluchis. And, you know, last year the in Musharraf regime also there was this offensive in Waziristan, and that was stopped. And therefore, the plurality of the character of Pakistan is being debated. And Ziaul-Haq's whole trend of homogenizing, trying to homogenize Pakistan into a sort of Sunni Pakistan following what is called the Deobandi school of thought. I mean, there are scholars here who know more about that. Is being debated. But American policy is premised on that homogeneous view of the Sunni Pakistan, just as in Iraq, you know, they really crystallized and exaggerated and now politicized the divisions of Shias, Sunnis, Kurds, and so on. And the Swat region, which has been in the news, and much of Pakistan is in the Sufi tradition. That's why, you know, Baba Des, Dargah Des, you know, those are the places which have been in the news in the recent weeks. So that's my first point. Strengthen the local forces of harmony and reason. And the movement for plurality, movement for that federal system is very strong in the subcontinent, and that has to be supported. The second proposition I would like to stress, Richard has already referred to, we have to respect the urges for self-determination. And much of the violence in the post-Second World War world is about that. From Palestine to Kashmir to Balochistan to Chechnya to Xinjiang to Tibet and so on. Self-determination sometimes can be solved by independence. Sometimes can be solved within countries. Pakistan, you know, Indian elite is trying, but has failed. Pakistan elite is trying. You know, the Balochi national movement is very strong. Last week they had some new initiatives for all-party conference on Balochistan and so on. Now, what is the U.S. policy premised on? It is not premised on an understanding of self-determination urges. For it, the strategic military superiority and stability and balance, that is all that they need. Our forum has a statement on Kashmir. Kashmir is not a territorial dispute. Sorry that Gilani said the other day, Prime Minister Gilani, that, oh, Kashmir is a land issue, whereas Taliban challenge is a issue of Pakistan's existence. I'm sorry, it's not a land issue. It's an issue, and this we tell to the elites of Pakistan, rulers of Pakistan and India, that it is an issue of Kashmir people's aspirations for self-determination. The form of that self-determination is something that has to be worked out by the people themselves with the regimes of India and Pakistan. And that is our forum stand. I strongly defend that stand. Now, and Pashtuns in this area, Swat area, Baluchis, Pakistan has to evolve out of the Punjabi Sindhi domination into a genuinely federal cooperative federation, just as India has, you know, the BJP's strategy of a centralized Hindu state. We have been fighting against that. Right now, the elections took place last month in Kashmir, Jammu and Kashmir. Jammu, of course, huge turnout. But in Kashmir, except in Ladakh, where there was 60% turnout, in Srinagar, there was only 21%. Baramulla, however, strangely enough, was almost 40%. In the other parts of the valley, it was 20 to 25. So there is a... but it's not 5%, 10%. So there is also a political process, which is having some impact. So that political process must allow talks with the autonomy movement, self-determination movements in Kashmir, and Hurriyat boycotted the elections. Hurriyat has to be drawn into the deliberations once again in Kashmir. So this is my second proposition, and I think we have to have a clear view that contemporary era violence is mainly the result of denial of self-determination, locally, regionally, but the U.S. policy, and you know, the imperialist period denied that, Cold War period denied that, and the present globalization period and the U.S. hegemonic military framework denies that. And that's why most of the sources of violence in the world. Now, finally, and this is a point which Cynthia has already referred to, we have to have a regional initiative. And in America, there is very little awareness of something called SARC or SCO, List of All EAS, East Asia Summit, which has ASEAN countries, India, China, Japan, and so on, because US is not a member here. Now, we also fight against these interstate organizations to say that, look, PAC India Forum gave a people's charter to SARC, but they adopted their own charter of development and fundamental rights. ASEAN has a charter of human rights. We from the Asian Human Rights Frame Network presented a charter. They didn't accept that. So we have a dialogue. I'm not saying that they are doing a great job, but they are a source of important regional cooperation initiative, not only in economic terms, but also in political terms. And SCO above all, India, Pakistan, and Iran are now observer members since 2006, together with Mongolia, in SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And they had a conference on Afghanistan crisis in early March. One junior official from State Department, U.S., also attended that. But you did not follow any of the discussions that were made there. Similarly, the SCO summit is going to take place in mid-June in Russia this time. This time Manmohan Singh himself is attending, because until now, because India is not an observer and India is a big power, so only a minister was attending. This time he has decided to attend. Of course, also the reason is that that meeting will be followed by India-China-Russia summit, the RIC, and also by BRIC, Brazil, India, China, Russia summit. Now, these are important initiatives. Involve them to confront this. And SCO started as a boundary-related initiative, post-Soviet situation. But after 9/11, after Xinjiang became more violent, Chechnya and so on, they are also concerned with this problem of terrorism, extremism, secessionism, fundamentalism, and so on. So what I'm saying is, and America, of course, considers that as a counter to U.S. But every time they say that this is not a counter to U.S. So there can be a NATO-SCO discussion at least. But more important than that is the belief that local problems have to be solved locally. And the participation of US in this great Eurasian game considering Pakistan as a strategic locale connecting West Asia, Middle East, Central Asia, and South Asia, and the Chinese help in Gwadar port, which has been completed recently in Pakistan. Now, you see, that does not become the only consideration if you are interested in peace in the region. Peace in the region depends on respect for plurality, respect for self-determination, and respect for the regional initiatives. And I would hope that the U.S.-India relationship, which will be now the focus with the new government in power, would look at Kashmir differently as an opportunity, as you said. I fully endorse that. And look at the regional problems from a regional angle and relate it to the global scenario, and so that U.S. gets the message that the threat to U.S. security can only be tackled when there is peace and self-determination all over the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Many of you have already heard about, I'm sure, the multi-billion dollar embassy that the U.S. is planning to build in Islamabad, sort of mimicking what they've done in Iraq, and we know how successful that has been. Kind of a new fortress, for American presence in the region, if it ever gets built, which is looks like it's, you know, likely to happen unless things change drastically. But I'd like to sort of take off from that and refer back to a previous U.S. embassy in Islamabad that was overrun by Pakistanis in 1979, thousands of them apparently. I wasn't there. It was completely unexpected on part of the CIA station officers that were there, the diplomats. Nobody expected this event to happen. And looking back to see what the catalysts were for that in 1979, there were several. One was the fact that it coincided with the seizure of the Mecca Haram area in the wake of the pilgrimage of that year, the Hajj, where Arab religious militants with a kind of millennial expectation seized the holy sites and had to be removed by force by the Saudi and French troops. That was one catalyst, I think, for that event. And the people that were engaging in the siege on the U.S. embassy and its seizure and burning, largely it was destroyed, were calling upon that as a Jewish-American conspiracy against Islam, and sort of indicates something of the facts that when we're thinking about what's going on in Pakistan and South Asia, I think we also have to take seriously the Middle Eastern connections that link us to that region of the world, and maybe thinking even in terms of the policy ramifications of those connections. The other factor that came into play here, obviously a factor that probably serves as an energizing force for the students, well, most of them were from Khad al-Azam University, as I understand it was sort of a major center for organizing the seizure of the embassy, was the Iranian Revolution that had happened in that 78-79 period, which also involved, you know, students seizing a U.S. embassy. And the success of that revolution, not that all the young Pakistanis were Shia Muslims, sort of motivated by Imam Husseini, Khomeini, but rather that the idea that somehow Islam could serve as a rallying force for political action in a revolutionary kind of way, I think, sent shockwaves through the Middle East and I think through South Asia as well, and Pakistan, not only among Shia Muslims, but among Sunni Muslims as well. And so I think that has to be looked at as a factor. And of course, coming out of Iran at this time in 79 was a very strong anti-American message of the Ayatollah Khomeini. And I think thirdly, another major factor that was involved was U.S. policy with respect to Israel. The fact that the demonstrators and the students were making reference to Israel being involved in a conspiracy to take off over the most holy sacred place in the Muslim world, I think reflects something of the consequences of U.S. Policy with respect to Israel, you know, at that time, and that still remains a major factor. So therefore, I think it would be wise for us in engaging in an effort to understand what's happening in Pakistan and in its neighbors, Afghanistan and India. We must take into consideration trans-regional as well as regional and local factors. We can't deal with it as a sort of nice little petri dish, you know, that this is where our only focus of relevance. We have to look more broadly. And on these levels, the religion of Islam plays a significant role, not only in terms of its specific beliefs and practices, but also in regards to its historical role in shaping politics, culture, and personal piety among the various peoples and nations in the region. Now, U.S. policy in the past has either discounted Islam completely, when basically religion was thought to be irrelevant, and we still see many foreign policy academics beginning to realize that foreign classes dealing with religion do not form part of the American foreign policy, education or training track. Certainly, economic development is part of it, and political dynamics is obviously part of it, but religion is not included in the preparation of our diplomats and policy analysts. And that's changing now somewhat, but there's still a remarkable lack of that going on. And so it's not surprising then to find that any consideration of Islam in terms of shaping U.S. relations with the Middle East or South Asia was not really very relevant or considered to be very relevant for much of the Cold War period. But the other side of that, though, is kind of the flip side of the coin, is that Islam was completely ignored, U.S. policy subsequently came to be obsessed with Islam in a way that sort of exceeds the bounds of rationality and rational thinking. And this obsession has also contributed to U.S. policy. So not only looking at strictly non-religious factors, secular factors in terms of the region, but also the way when religion is included into it, it's done in a way that affects the U.S. policy, I think, in a detrimental kind of way. So this obsession with religion in the region emerged during the last phases of the Cold War politics period. It's marked in particular then by the Iranian Revolution and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and this obsession continues then to be part of our foreign policy in the present day. Now, Mahmoud Mamdani has been particularly helpful, I think, in diagnosing this obsession and pointing out its unintended consequences. The Manichaean conceptualization of Islam as being divided into two camps, good Muslims / bad Muslims, I think is really one of the operating concepts in terms of this religious understanding or obsession with Islam that has formed part of our foreign policy apparatus. So good Muslims, you can imagine from in this kind of way of looking at the world, are those who deserve, U.S. support and help in order to help the U.S. Pursue its global strategic interests. Or good Muslims are what some people, Muslims, call American Muslims. Other people call them Reader's Digest Muslims, who are just not political at all, but look at Islam as sort of a pietistic thing that, as long as they're being pious and keep religion to themselves, that's okay. So either those folks are okay, or the ones that will serve more militantly our foreign policy interests are good. And Mamdani then links these more militant forms of Muslims with the proxy wars that were part of its Cold War strategy. In other words, you find some insurgent, guerrilla-type organization to direct them against leftist forces in whatever part of the world you're looking at. Part of that is Latin America, but then we also have the Middle Eastern version of this, and the most obvious example is the case of Afghanistan, where we then drew upon the refugees and guerrilla fighters from the Afghan population and arm them and train them and finance them to engage in war against Soviet forces occupying the country at that time. Now, the U.S. was not alone in doing this, in engaging in this proxy war in Afghanistan with our good Muslim allies. We also cooperated and won the the loyalty in a way of the Saudis and Saudi cash flow into Pakistan, which was then used to then fund the Afghani Mujahideen. And then we also had on our side the Pakistani ISI. And they were, you know, more immediately in the field, although the CIA did have its own operatives in the region as well. So the result of, you know, promoting these good Muslims certainly, you know, involved in part the defeat of the Soviets. But the negative aspect of that, obviously, has been brought out already, is that you had then a long civil war between varying Mujahideen factions that tore Afghanistan apart. And you had the rise of radical Islamist organization like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. In other words, our good Muslims morphed into our bad Muslims in a way that we saw very clearly demonstrated in 9/11, but also in the current violence that's occurring in Afghanistan and Pakistan in particular. So what I'd like to do in terms of this trans-regional perspective that I'd like to put on this question is focus on Saudi Arabia and its involvement with Pakistan. Now, Barbara Metcalf has talked about Islam, and others have recognized this too, have talked about Islam as a central pillar of Pakistan's national identity, and I think we all recognize that, and it's already been brought up this morning. But she points out that this identity has been shaped not only by regional factors, but also by trans-regional ones. In the wake of partition, Islam's, you know, Pakistan's Islamic identity was used to push it away from its historical and cultural connections in India. And as long as there was some kind of, you know, umbrella sort of use of Islamic symbols and things like that, that was sufficient in terms of juxtaposing the new nation Pakistan's a national identity from that of India. In the 1970s, Pakistan's Islamic identity was reconstructed, beginning with Ali Bhutto, not Zia-ul-Haq, beginning with Ali Bhutto and continuing on in a different kind of way with Zia-ul-Haq, in a way that caused those Islamic symbols, which are sort of generally understood to be creating some kind of sense of Pakistani national identity, to actually trying to somehow bring Islam into operation on the ground and use it as a basis for gaining political support within the country. And that followed in the wake of the loss of Bangladesh, you know, East Pakistan. I think it caused a huge crisis in terms of the country's own identity. In a sense, Pakistan wondering, you know, West Pakistan, what's going to happen next? Are we going to continue to fragment, and how do we try to keep our different ethnic groups, still together as one kind of nation state? So Islam became the unifying factor in that context. But when you're trying to think about Islam, then, in Pakistan, we have to think about the diversity of forms that Islam takes there. So there's not just the sort of the ways in which the government seeks to use it to sort of create some kind of broadly Pakistani national identity, but the way it's actually embedded within the everyday life of the Pakistanis and its recent history. So certainly you have a kind of Islam that's Sunni Islam, but is defined by a kind of secular modernist Sunni outlook, where, again, it's a matter more of personal practice, but, you know, conceived of as being in congruity with the forces for modern thinking, science, development, technology, and et cetera. So that certainly is there, especially among core elites within Pakistan. But you also have the Deobandi traditionalist ulama and students, which is a kind of pietistic form of Islam that's focuses on the literal understanding of the Quran and the study of the Hadith, and trying to implement the teachings of the Quran and the Hadith in the daily lives of Muslims, overtly, not to be political, though. Okay, the Deobandi school is not immediately, designed to engage in political action. They come out of the the colonial period in India, the late colonial period, where they basically chose not to oppose the British rule of India, and rather wanted to sort of strengthen Islam from within in terms of getting back to the true religion and having Indian Muslims become good Muslims in terms of knowing what their religion says and what it requires, et cetera, but not in terms of engaging in overt political action. So you have this kind of traditionalist-minded ulama, religious scholars, and their students. However, that Deobandi tradition of Islam then does have its offshoots. And I think the Taliban movement is one that certainly has been pointed out by Mona already. And that's, you know, sort of, again, grounded in this traditionalist sort of view of the Islamic religion, but without any reference to the complex legal tradition that developed over the centuries, rather than trying to go back to the original text of the Quran and the Hadith. But then we also have, you know, and that becoming then militarized, and I think the militarization of the Taliban is, you know, a combination of the refugee conditions in Western Pakistan, compounded with the anti-Soviet guerrilla wars that the U.S. and the Pakistani ISI in Saudi Arabia were promoting, et cetera. So we have then the militarization of this offshoot of the Deobandi tradition. But there's another offshoot of the Deobandi tradition that is huge. I mean, with the Taliban, I think in terms of militants, they're just talking about tens of thousands of people that might be involved in the Taliban sort of militant movement. But, you know, more significant coming out of the Deobandi movement is Tablighi movement, which involves millions. When they have their gatherings in Pakistan, you have a gathering of 2 million or more people at their gathering. And Tablighis, too, then follow this Deobandi tradition of piety, inner piety. And for them, jihad means carrying the message of being good, pious Muslims to other Muslims. It doesn't mean taking a sword and fighting, you know, the kafirs, the unbelievers, and things like that, or trying to create an Islamic government. So we have that factor, element of Islam that's present, too. Another way in which Islam is formed within the Pakistani context is the Jamaat Islami, which is more or less a political party that does seek to create an Islamic government following the teachings of Abu Ala al-Maududi. But again, it's a minority party. It's not a dominant party. It doesn't have a large, following. They look at themselves as a vanguard or an elite that eventually, you know, the rest of the people sort of wake up to their message and follow them to help them achieve their goals. And they're certainly active in Pakistani politics and influential, but they're not a dominant factor in terms of the overall, spectrum. You have Sufi-minded Muslims. And with their forms of Sufi piety and the shrine forms of Islam that they represent as another factor, not only in terms of the religious spectrum in Pakistan, but also the political spectrum, because these Sufi organizations do get involved in the politics of the country, but not in the same way as these other groups that we've talked about. You have the Shia. Anywhere from 18% to 20% of Pakistan's population. The 12 are Shia, are the largest group, you know, the ones that would have the closest identification with the kind of 12 are Shiism that you find dominant in Iran. But you also have then Ismaili Shia in significant numbers, which reflect, a not so politicized form of Shiite Islam in Pakistan. Not to mention, then, we have this other group, and this formed one of the defining issues for what Islam is in Pakistan, are the Ahmadiyya Muslims, and sort of their presence in a significant way in Pakistan. So the picture of the, of Islam in Pakistan is a very varied and diverse one. And I think that from the point of view of the U.S. media and what we hear, the policy statements that are being made by our leaders, is one that, you're really dealing with good Muslims or bad Muslims there. And they don't have a sense of the complexity of the picture there and how this complexity in terms of the religious identities of the people in Pakistan is relevant to understanding what's happening on the ground and trying to understand how influential the Taliban might be, that those other expressions of Islam have to be taken into consideration, any thinking about potential Taliban seizure of the country, etc. the cross-cutting this variety of understandings of Islam that's present there, you also have the ethnic identities. And Professor Mahanty drew attention to this, is, you know, developing a more kind of greater sense of the plural identities and forces at work that are not religious in Pakistan. And so here you're dealing with, obviously, the Punjabis being the ones that have dominated Pakistani politics since independence, with the Sindhis being very influential, too, particularly through the Bhutto family. But there also, you have to take into consideration the Baluchis and the Pashtuns being the ones that have the closest intersection with the Afghani context. And the Saraikis. Saraiki Pakistanis then are those that have been more associated with this kind of, they consider themselves in part to be the salt of the earth, the real indigenous Pakistanis of the Indus Valley. And their Islam is one that seeks to try to bridge between the different branches of Islamic religion in the country, and where Sufism, I think, is particularly important in that part of the Indian Pakistani ethnoscape. So those are, you know, I think all factors that have to be looked at carefully, the pluralities of understandings of Islam and the pluralities of ethnic identity and how they are contending with each other or intersecting with each other. And again, the picture is much more complex than I think our strategists on the Pentagon or the State Department are conceiving at the present time. Now, with respect to Saudi influence, I know that my time is limited here, so I'll just quickly go through that. But I think that you can see the Saudi influence in Pakistan picking up in the early 1970s as Bhutto sought to make Islam a more prominent part of the Pakistani self-understanding in the world. And he convened a conference there of Muslim leaders in Islamabad, and among them was Saudi King Faisal. So in the wake of that, we have the changing of one of the names of a Pakistani city to Faisalabad. And then you have the building of the Grand Faisal Mosque in Islamabad as well, sort of an outward expressions of the new Saudi opening into Pakistan. That shift on the part of Ali Bhutto's government then coincided also with what? The increasing revenues from oil, the oil market. And so Pakistan began to look to Saudi Arabia as a source for building its economy. In various ways, either through direct Saudi investment and transfers of wealth, or through the establishment of labor migration relations, so that allowed workers to go into Saudi Arabia and work on those oil fields or these subsidiary companies that were connected with it. So we have then the beginning of a significant Saudi presence in Pakistan at that time with Ali Bhutto, although Bhutto's Islam was not the Saudi Wahhabi form of Islam. It was, you know, much more pluralistic in nature, and probably, you know, an effort on his part to construct his own Islam for Pakistan, rather than sort of affiliated with any kind of existing Islam that was on the ground or, you know, locally or transregionally. The one who tried to sort of bring, I think, the Pakistani government's definition of Islam closer to that of the Saudis was Zia-ul-Haq. And then his kind of piecemeal attempt to sort of impose elements of the Islamic law in the country, which were not that effective, nonetheless may have been, you know, sort of a gesture to the Saudis that he was more sympathetic to them than even Ali Bhutto was in the initial stages. So with that, during Zia-ul-Huq's reign, we have the funding of the Saudis for madrasas in the northwestern frontier province. The Saudis then are contributing funds to the Afghan Mujahideen, you know, during the 1980s. They provide support for sending soldiers and arms into the Kashmir. So, you know, obviously, if you know something about the economy of Pakistan, it is not a wealthy country to begin with. So where are they getting the funds to engage in these kinds of activities, supplying the Mujahideen in Afghanistan or supplying the Mujahideen in Kashmir? You're getting, in part, yes, the U.S. is helping, but in many ways, the Saudis were major contributors. Pakistan joined with Saudi Arabia when the Taliban government was created to be one of the only three countries in the world to recognize the Taliban as a legitimate government. The third one was the United Arab Emirates. I think in the United Arab Emirates, 80% of its population are guest workers. And a lot of those are from India and Pakistan. So you can probably see why the UAE might be interested in joining with Pakistan and Saudi Arabia in recognizing that government. And if you read the accounts of some of the Saudi political leaders, Faisal Turki, for example, is one, about the Saudi support for the Taliban, it indicates that there was not only sort of a fact that they were Muslims and they were being besieged by communists and invaders and trying to bring back some kind of Islamic government, but there's also a sense that some of these Saudi figures saw the Taliban as kind of a latter-day version of themselves, the Wahhabis, that you had a sort of group from a marginal status in society, moving into the fore and trying to seize control of a country and establish a government according to Islamic law. So there was kind of a sense of seeing something of yourself in the Taliban and an attraction into supporting them and achieving their goals. Now, in terms of Pakistanis going into Saudi Arabia, then we have Bhutto beginning a policy of sending Pakistani troops into Saudi Arabia to involved in training and operations in the country, about 15,000 during the 1970s and 80s. Migrant labor currently during the beginning of the 21st century, between 900,000 and 1 million Pakistanis working in Saudi Arabia, and so that represents about 1 million, 1/6 of the foreign labor force in Saudi Arabia. Indians are slightly larger. Indian guest workers in Saudi Arabia are slightly larger than the Pakistani one. Again, one would have to assume, I don't have the statistics on this, but one would have to assume that the Indian labor force in Saudi Arabia is largely Muslim. But you have that kind of cooperation. And now, as you look sort of more in recent years, the Saudis have developed an economic policy that is relying less on that of Europe and the United States as sort of their main markets, and they're looking more to the east for investment and development. And so Saudi Arabia and other GCC countries are now planning with the Pakistani government to engage in enhanced sorts of economic development and economic exchanges and projects in Pakistan. So obviously, from a financial point of view, we're looking to see increasing Saudi financial interest involved in Pakistan. With respect to pilgrimage, then, the pilgrimage to Mecca, there too, that's been part of this way of establishing a close connection between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, where you have, during the 1970s, the beginning of sending of a huge increase of the number of pilgrims to Saudi Arabia from that country, reaching as high as 100,000 per year. And I look at that, again, as another factor that involves not only the relations between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, but that who gets chosen to go to Saudi Arabia is determined in large part by the Pakistani government. And so depending on who the political party is that's in control of the government, it helps shape the composition of the pilgrims going from the country. The Pakistan People's Party, or that of Ali Bhutto, and Benazir Bhutto as well, tended to want to make the Hajj more open to all Pakistanis and use it as a sort of way to get swing voters from parts of the population that were not normally inclined to vote for Bhutto and his party. So in other words, they were taking strength from both the Punjabis in the elections, using the Hajj as a way to do that, and the Pashtuns as well, in areas where, again, the PPP was weak, and one factor used was the pilgrimage. Ziaul-Haq, on the other hand, liked to reward the military with pilgrimage, the landed wealthy classes, and the government bureaucrats. So largely Punjabis, therefore. And so you have the Hajj composition shaped under Zia-ul Haq, you know, sort of, you know, reflecting that that place within, or that aspect of the Pakistani population. Again, you have these transregional factors, but they're also playing into the domestic politics as well, and where you're winning swing voters from and loyalty from within the country. In conclusion, then, it seems to me that U.S. policy in the region, if it's really concerned for working towards peace, really can only change when it recognizes the complex profile of Islam there, and in Pakistan in particular, as well as I think the U.S. has to develop a strategy for managing the Saudi influence in the region. It seems that the Saudi government, again, this is a major problem for the U.S., is a you know, close ally to the United States. It maybe is, you know, as close, if not more close, than Israel. And so trying to control the Saudi influence within Pakistan in the current scene and in the years to come, I think, is going to be a major challenge. And we better start thinking about how to manage that, as at the same time we're trying to think about the different Taliban factions, et cetera, that might be playing a role in terms of the conflict in the region. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.